told a story, and the general was a hilarious storyteller. The punchline was usually at his own expense. He loved to tell about the time he went to great lengths to hire a rock band with $5,000 out of his own pocket to entertain his troops, mired for months in the Sinai Desert on a peacekeeping mission, only to have an unsuspecting soldier cheerfully inform him that the band sucked. He'd shift the cigar stub to the other side of his mouth and grin sheepishly. He could even joke about his own ambition, a rarity in the army. "If you guys keep pulling this shit," he'd whine to his executive staff, "how am I ever going to make general?" On his career climb to leadership of JSOC, Joint Special Operations Command, he'd served a stint as Delta Commander. When he arrived at Bragg as a newly leafed colonel in the mid-80s, his crew cut alone invited scorn and suspicion from the D-boys, with their sideburns and facial hair and civilian haircuts down over their ears. But soon after he started, Garrison saved their ass. Some of America's secret super soldiers were caught double-dipping expenses, billing both the Army and the State Department for their covert international travel. The scandal could have brought down the unit, which was despised by the more traditional brass anyway. The new bullet-headed colonel could have scored points and greased his own promotional path by expressing outrage and cleaning house. Instead, Garrison placed his career in jeopardy by defending the unit and focusing punishment on only the worst abusers. He'd salvaged a fair number of professional hides in that caper, and the men hadn't forgotten. In time, his insouciant Lone Star style and understated confidence rubbed off on the whole unit. There were guys from suburban New Jersey who, after weeks with Delta, were wearing pointy boots, dipping tobacco, and drawling like a cowpoke. Garrison had been living for weeks now in the JOC, mostly in a small private office off the operations room, where he could stretch his long legs and prop his boots up on the desk and shut out all the noise. Noise was one of the biggest problems in a deal like this. You had to separate out signals from the noise. There was nothing of the generals in this private space, no family photos or memorabilia. It was the way he lived. He could walk out of that building at a moment's notice and leave behind no personal trace. The idea was to finish the job and vanish. Until then, it was an around-the-clock operation. The general had a trailer out back where he retreated at irregular intervals to grab about 5 hours of sleep, but usually he was camped in his command post, poised, ready to pounce. Take the previous night, for instance. First, they were informed that Ideed, who had been codenamed Yogi the Bear, was paying a visit to the Sheikh Aden Adairi compound up the Black Sea. A local spy had been told this by a servant who worked there. So powerful cameras zoomed in from the Orion, the fat old four-prop Navy spy plane that flew circles high over the city almost continually, and Garrison's two little observation birds spun up. The troops pulled on their gear. The Aden Adairi compound was one of their pre-planned targets, so the workup time was nil. But they couldn't commit, or at least Garrison refused to commit, without firmer intelligence. The task force had been embarrassed too often already. Before he launched, Garrison wanted two of the Somali spies to enter the compound and actually see Ideed. Then he wanted them to drop an infrared strobe by the target building. Two informants managed to get in the compound, but then exited without accomplishing either task. There were more guards than usual, they explained, maybe 40. They continued to insist that Ideed was in the compound, so why didn't the Rangers just move? Garrison demanded that one of them return with the strobe, find Yogi the fucking bear, and mark the damn spot. Only now the informants said they couldn't get back in. It was dark, past 9 p.m., and the gates had been locked for the night. The guards wanted a password the spies didn't know. which was all just bad luck, perhaps. Garrison reluctantly scratched another mission. The pilots and crews shut down their helicopters, and the soldiers all stripped back down and went back to their cots. Then came a late bulletin. The same Somali spies said Idid had now left the compound in a three-vehicle convoy with lights out. One of their number had followed the convoy west, they said, toward the Olympic Hotel, but lost it when the vehicles turned north toward October 21st road. All of which sounded significant, except that the two OH-58s were still in place, equipped with night vision cameras that lit up the view like green-tinted noon, and neither they nor anyone watching the screens back at the command center were seeing any of this. As a result of this, we have experienced some weariness between the local spy ring and the task force. Garrison wrote out longhand that morning at his desk in his operations center, venting a little of the frustration that had built up over 43 days. The memo was addressed to Marine General Joseph Hoare, his commander at CENTCOM, U.S. Central Command, located at MacDill Air Force Base in Tampa, Florida. Generally, the local spy ring appears to believe that a second-hand report from an individual who is not a member of the team should be sufficient to constitute current intelligence. I do not. Furthermore, when a local spy ring team member is reporting something that is totally different than what our helicopters are seeing, which we watch here back at the JOC, I naturally weigh the launch decision toward what we actually see versus what is being reported. Events such as last night, with Team 2 stating that Idid had just left the compound in a three-vehicle convoy. When we know for a fact that no vehicles left the compound, tends to lower our confidence level even more. There had been too many close calls and near misses. Too much time between missions. In 6 weeks, they'd launched exactly 6 times, and several of these missions had been less than bang-up successes. After that first raid, when they'd arrested the 9 UN employees at the Lig Ligato compound, Washington had been very upset. Joint Chiefs of Staff Chairman Colin Powell would later say, "I had to screw myself off the ceiling." The United States apologized, and all the captives were promptly released. On September 14th, the assault force had stormed what turned out to be the residence of Somali General Amin Jallow, a close ally of the UN, and the man being groomed to lead the projected Somali police force. The troops were restless and just wanted to hit something, anything. In this frame of mind, it didn't take much of an excuse to launch. When one of the rangers thought he'd spotted Idid in a convoy of cars outside the Italian embassy, the assault force was rallied and a duly startled General Jallow was arrested along with 38 others. Again, an apology. All of the suspects were released. In a cable detailing the debacle for officials in Washington the next day, U.S. Envoy Robert Gosend wrote, "We understand that some damages to the premises took place. General Jallow has received apologies from all concerned. We don't know if the person mistaken for General Idid was General Jallow. It would be hard to confuse him with Idid. Jallow is approximately 10 inches taller than Idid. Idid is very dark. Jallow has a much lighter complexion. Idid is slim and has sharp Semitic-like features. Jallow is overweight and round-faced. We are very concerned that this episode might find its way into the press." That episode didn't, but among official circles, the task force again looked like Keystone Cops. Never mind that every one of these missions was a masterpiece of coordination and execution, difficult and dangerous as hell. So far, none of his men had been seriously hurt. Never mind that their latest outing had netted Osman Ato, Idid's money man and one of his inner circle. Washington was impatient. Congress wanted American soldiers home, and the Clinton administration wanted to remove Idid as a player in Somalia. August had turned to September, had turned to October. One more day was one day too long for the wishes of America and the world to be stymied by this Mogadishu warlord. This man, America's UN ambassador Madeleine K. Albright had labeled a thug. Garrison could ill afford another misstep, even though caution could mean missing opportunities. He knew that his superiors, and even some people on his own staff, thought he was being too tentative about choosing missions. With such shaky work on the ground, what could you expect? As a rule, we will launch if a member of the local spy ring reports he has seen Idid or his lieutenants. Our reconnaissance helo picture approximates what is being reported, and the report is current enough to be actionable. Garrison wrote in his memo to Hoare, "There is no place in Mogadishu we cannot go and be successful in a fight. There are plenty of places we can go and be stupid." And just that morning, like manna, the general's rigid criteria had been met. Every Sunday morning, the Habergideer held a rally out by the reviewing stand on Via Lenin, where they hurled insults at the UN and its American enforcers. One of the main speakers that morning was Omar Salad, Idid's top political adviser. The Klan had not caught on yet that the Rangers had targeted the entire top rung of Idid's gang, so Salad wasn't even trying to hide. He was one of the UN's Tier 1 personalities. When the rally broke up, his white Toyota Land Cruiser and some cars were watched from on high as they drove north toward the Bukhara market. Salad was observed entering a house one block north of the Olympic Hotel. At about 1:30 p.m. came confirmation from a Somali spy who radioed that Salad was meeting with Abdi Gibdid Hassan Awali, Idid's ostensible interior minister. Two major targets. Idid might also be there, but again, nobody had actually seen him. High above, the Orion zoomed its cameras in on the neighborhood, and the observation choppers took off. They moved up over the Black Sea to watch the same street. The TV screens in the JOC showed many people and cars on the streets, a typical weekend afternoon at the market. To mark the precise location where Salad and Gebdid were meeting, a Somali informant had been instructed to drive his car, a small silver sedan with red stripes on its doors, to the front of the hotel, get out, lift the hood, and peer into it as if he were having engine trouble. This would give the helicopter cameras a chance to lock on him. He was then to drive north and stop directly in front of the target house where the Klan leaders had convened. The informant did as instructed, but performed the check under his hood so quickly that the helicopters failed to fix on him. So he was told to do it again. This time he was to drive directly to the target building, get out, and open the car hood. Garrison and his staff watched this little drama unfold on their screens. The helicopter cameras provided a clear color view of the busy scene as the informant's car entered the picture driving north on Holwadig Road. It stopped before a building alongside the hotel. The informant got out and opened the hood. There was no mistaking the spot. Word passed quietly to the hangar, and the Rangers and D-boys started kitting up. The Delta team leaders met and planned out their attack, using instant photo maps relayed from the observation birds to plan exactly how they would storm the building and where the Ranger blocking positions would be. Copies of the plan were handed out to all the chalk leaders, and the helicopters were readied. Just as Garrison was preparing to launch, however, everything was placed on hold. The spy had stopped his car short. He was on the right street, but he'd chickened out. Nervous about moving so close to the target house, he'd stopped down the street a ways and opened the hood there. Despite Garrison's finicky precautions, the task force had been minutes away from launching an assault on the wrong house. The commanders all hustled back into the JOC to regroup. The informant, who wore a small two-way radio strapped to his leg, was instructed to go back around the block and this time stop in front of the right goddamn house. They watched on the screens as the car came back up Holwadig Road. This time it went past the Olympic Hotel and stopped one block north on the other side of the street. This was the same building the observation choppers had observed Salad entering earlier. It was now 3 o'clock. Garrison staff informed General Thomas Montgomery, second in command of all UN troops in Somalia, and direct commander of the 10th Mountain Division's Quick Reaction Force, QRF, that they were about to launch. Then Garrison sought confirmation that there were no UN or charitable organizations, non-governmental organizations, or NGOs in the vicinity. A safeguard instituted after the arrests of the UN employees in the Ligligato raid. All aircraft were ordered out of the airspace over the target. The commanders of the 10th Mountain Division were told to keep one company on standby alert. Intelligence forces began jamming all radios and cellular phones. MOG had no regular working phone system. The general made a last-minute decision to upload rockets on the little birds. Lieutenant Jim Lechner, the Ranger Company's fire support officer, had been pushing for it. Lechner knew that if things got bad on the ground, he'd love to be able to call in those rockets. The two pods on the AH-6s each carried 6 missiles. In the quick planning session, Lechner asked again, "Are we getting rockets today?" Garrison told him, "Roger." Chapter 4. Ali Hassan Mohammed ran to the front door of his father's hamburger and candy shop when the choppers came down and the shooting started. He was a student, a tall and slender teenager with prominent cheekbones and a sparse goatee. He studied English and business in the mornings and afternoons manned the store, which was just up from the Olympic Hotel. The front door was across Holwadig Road, diagonal from the house of Abdurrahman Youssef Gale, where the Rangers seemed to be attacking. Peering out the doorway, Ali saw American soldiers sliding down on ropes to the alley that ran west off Holwadig. His shop was on the corner of that street, and the gate to his family's home was just down from there. The Americans were shooting as soon as they hit the ground, shooting at everything. There were also Somalis shooting at them. These soldiers, Ali knew, were different than the ones who had come to feed Somalis. These were Rangers. They were cruel men who wore body armor and strapped their weapons to their chests, and when they came at night, they painted their faces to look fierce. Further up Holwadig, to his left, about 2 blocks over, another group of Rangers were in pitched battle. He saw 2 of them drag another who looked dead out of the street. The Rangers across the street entered a courtyard there and were shooting out. Then a helicopter came down low and blasted streams of fire from a gun on its side. The gun just pulverized his side of the street. Ali's youngest brother, Abdullahi Hassan Mohammed, fell dead by the gate to the family's house, bleeding from the head. Abdullahi was 15. Ali saw it happen. Then the Rangers ran out of the courtyard and across Holwadig toward the house of Abdurrahman Youssef Gale, where most of the other soldiers were. Ali ran. He stopped to see his brother and saw his head broken open like a melon. Then he took off as fast as he could. He ran to his left, down the street away from the Rangers and the house they were attacking. At the end of the dirt alley, he turned left and ran behind the Olympic Hotel. The streets were crowded with screaming women and children. People were scrambling everywhere, racing around dead people and dead animals. Some who were running went toward the fight, and others ran away from it. Some did not seem to know which way to go. He saw a woman running naked, waving her arms and screaming. Above was the din of the helicopters, and all around the crisp popping of gunfire. Out in the streets, there were already ID'd militiamen with megaphones shouting, "Kasubaksa guryaha uiska selsakadoga! Come out and defend your homes!" Ali was not a fighter. There were gunmen. They called them Muryan, who lived for rice and cut, and belonged to the private armies of rich men. Ali was just a student and part-time shopkeeper who joined the neighborhood militia to protect its shops from the Muryan. But these rangers were invading his home and had just killed his brother. He ran with rage and terror behind the hotel, and then, turning left again, back across Holwadig Road, to the house of his friend Ahmed, where his AK-47 was hidden. Once he had retrieved the gun, he met up with several of his friends. They ran back behind the Olympic Hotel, through all the chaos. Ali told them about his brother, and led them back to his house and shop, determined to exact revenge. Hiding behind a wall behind the hotel, they fired their first shots at the rangers on the corner. Then they moved north, ducking behind cars and buildings. Ali would jump out and spray bullets toward the rangers, then run for cover. Then one of his friends would do the same. Sometimes they just pushed the barrels of their guns around the corners and sprayed bullets without looking. None of them was an experienced fighter. The rangers were better shots. Ali's friend, Adun Warsawe, stepped out to shoot and was hit in the stomach by a ranger bullet that knocked him flat on his back. Ali and another friend risked the shooting to drag Adun to cover. The bullet had punched a hole in Adun's gut and made a gaping wound out his back that had sprayed blood on the dirt. When they dragged him, it left a smear of blood on the street. Adun looked both alive and dead, as though he were someplace in between. Ali moved on to the next street, leaving Adun with two friends. He would shoot a ranger or die trying. Why were they doing this? Who were these Americans who came to his neighborhood spraying bullets and spreading death? Chapter 5. After bursting into the storehouse off Holwadig, Sergeant Paul Howe and the three other men on his Delta team rounded the corner and entered the target building from the southern courtyard door. They were the last of the assault forces to enter the house. A team led by Howe's buddy Matt Ryerson had already rounded up 24 Somali men on the first floor, among them two prizes, Omar Salad, the primary target, and Mohammed Hassan Awale, Aidid's chief spokesman, not Abdi Gebdid Hassan Awale, as reported, but a clan leader of equal stature. They were prone and docile, and Ryerson's team was locking their wrists together with plastic cuffs. Howe asked Sergeant Mike Foreman if anyone had gone upstairs. "Not yet," Foreman said. So Howe took his four men up to the second floor. It was a big house by Somali standards, whitewashed cinder block walls and windows with no glass in them. At the top step, Howe called for one of his men to toss a flashbang grenade into the first room. It exploded, and the team burst in as they were trained to do, each man covering a different firing lane. They found only a mattress on the floor. As they moved around the room, a volley of machine gun fire slammed into the ceiling and wall, just missing the head of one of Howe's men. They all dropped down. The rounds had come through the southeast window and had clearly come from the ranger blocking position just below the window. One of the younger soldiers outside had evidently seen someone moving in the window and fired. Obviously, some of these guys weren't clear which building was the target. It was what he had feared. Howe was disappointed in the Rangers. These were supposed to be the Army's crack infantry. Despite all the hype and hoo-ah horseshit, he saw the younger men as poorly trained and potentially dangerous in combat. Most were fresh out of high school. During training exercises, he had the impression that they were always craning their necks to watch him and his men, instead of paying attention to their own very important part of the job. And the job demanded more. It demanded all you had and more, because the price of failure was often death. That's why Howe and the rest of these D-boys loved it. It separated them from other men. War was ugly and evil, for sure, but it was still the way things got done on most of the planet. Civilized states had nonviolent ways of resolving disputes, but that depended on the willingness of everyone involved to back down. Here, in the raw Third World, people hadn't learned to back down, at least not until after a lot of blood flowed. Victory was for those willing to fight and die. Intellectuals could theorize until they sucked their thumbs right off their hands, but in the real world, power still flowed from the barrel of a gun. If you wanted the starving masses in Somalia to eat, then you had to outmuscle men like this Ideed, for whom starvation worked. You could send in your bleeding heart do-gooders. You could hold hands and pray and sing hootenanny songs and invoke the great gods CNN and BBC. But the only way to finally open the roads to the big-eyed babies was to show up with more guns. And in this real world, nobody had more or better guns than America. If the good-hearted ideals of humankind were to prevail, then they needed men who could make it happen. Delta made it happen. They operated strictly in secret. The army would not even speak the word Delta. If you had to refer to them, they were operators, or the dreaded D. The Rangers, who worshipped them, called them D-boys. Secrecy, or at least the show of it, was central to their purpose. It allowed the dreamers and the politicians to have it both ways. They could stay on the high road while the dirty work happened off stage. If some third-world terrorist or Colombian drug lord needed to die, and then suddenly just turned up dead, why, what a happy coincidence. The dark soldiers would melt back into shadow. If you asked them about how they made it happen, they wouldn't tell. They didn't even exist, see? They were noble, silent, and invisible. They did America's most important work, yet shunned recognition, fame, and fortune. They were modern knights and true. Howe did little to disguise his scorn for lower orders of soldiering, which pretty much included the whole regular U.S. Army. He and the rest of the operators lived like civilians, and that's what they told you they were, if you asked, although spotting them down at Fort Bragg wasn't hard. You'd meet this guy hanging out at a bar around Bragg, deeply tanned, biceps rippling, neck wide as a fire plug, with a giant Casio watch and a plug of chaw under his lip. And he'd tell you he worked as a computer programmer for some army contract agency. They called each other by their nicknames and eschewed salutes and all the other traditional trappings of military life. Officers and non-coms in Delta treated each other as equals. Disdain for normal displays of army status was the unit's signature. They simply transcended rank. They wore their hair longer than army regs. They needed to pose as civilians on some missions, and it was easier to do that if they had normal haircuts. But it was also a point of pride with them, one of their perks. A cartoon drawn by a unit wit showed the typical D-boy dressed for battle with his hip holster stuffed, not with a gun, but a hairdryer. Every year they were obliged to pose for an official army portrait, and for it they had to get ranger-style haircuts. They hated it. They'd had to sit for buzzes before this trip to better blend in with the hoo-has, and the haircuts had just made them stick out even more. The sides and backs of their heads were as white as frog bellies. They were allowed a degree of personal freedom and initiative unheard of in the military, particularly in battle. The price they paid for all this, of course, was that they lived with danger and were expected to do what normal soldiers could not. Howe wasn't impressed with a lot of things about the regular army. He and others in his unit had complained to Captain Steele, the Ranger commander, about his men's readiness. They hadn't gotten anywhere. Steele had his own way of doing things, and that was the traditional army way. Howe found the spit-and-polish captain, a massive former University of Georgia football lineman, to be an arrogant and incompetent buffoon. Howe had been through Ranger school and earned the tab himself, but had skipped straight over the Rangers when he qualified for Delta. He disdained the Rangers in part because he believed hard, realistic, stair-stepped training made good soldiers, not the bullshit macho attitude epitomized by the whole hoo-ah esprit. Out of the 120 men who tried out for Delta in his class, these were 120 highly motivated, exceptional soldiers. Only 13 had made it through selection and training. Howe had the massive frame of a serious bodybuilder and a fine, if impatient, analytical mind. Many of the Rangers found him scary. His contempt for their ways colored relationships between the two units in the hangar. Now Howe's misgivings about the younger support troops were confirmed. They were shooting at their own men. Howe and his team left the room with the mattress and then moved out to clear the flat roof over the front of the house. It was enclosed by a 3-foot concrete wall with decorative vertical slats. As the Delta team fanned out into sunlight, they saw the small orange fireball of an AK-47 erupt from a rooftop one block north. Two of Howe's team returned fire as they ducked behind the low wall for cover. Then another burst of machine gun rounds erupted. There were inch-wide slits in the perimeter wall. Howe and his men crouched and prayed a round didn't pass through an opening or ricochet back off the outside of the house. There were several long bursts. They could tell by the sound and impact of the rounds that the shots were being fired by an M249, or SAW, squad automatic weapon, this time from the northeast Ranger blocking position. The Rangers were under fire. They were overeager and scared, so when they saw men with weapons, they fired. Howe was furious. He radioed Captain Scott Miller, the Delta ground commander, down in the courtyard. He told him to get Steele on the radio immediately and tell him to stop his men from shooting at their own people. Chapter 6 Specialist John Stebbins ran as soon as his feet hit the ground. Just before boarding the helicopter, Captain Steele had tapped him on the shoulder. "Stebbins, you know the rules of engagement?"
"Yeah, roger, sir. I know 'em."
"Okay. I want you to know I'm going to be on the fast rope right after you, so you better keep moving." The prospect of the broad-beamed commander, fully laden with battle gear, bearing down on his helmet, had haunted Stebbins the whole flight in. After roping down, he scrambled so fast from the bottom of the rope that he collided with Chalk One's M60 gunner, and they both fell down. Stebbins lay there for a moment, waiting for the dust to clear, and then spotted the rest of his team up against a wall to his right. He was scared, but thrilled. He couldn't shake the feeling that this was all too good to be true. Here he was, an old-timer in the Ranger Company at age 28, having spent the last 4 years of his life trying to get into combat, to do something interesting or important, and now, somehow, through an incredible chain of pleading, wheedling, and freakish breaks, he was actually in combat. Him, stubby Johnny Stebbins, the company's chief coffee maker and training room paper pusher, at war. His trip to this Mogadishu back alley had started in a bagel shop at home in Ithaca, New York. Stebbins was a short, stocky kid with pale blue eyes and blonde hair, and skin so white and freckly it never turned even the faintest shade darker in the sun. Here in Mog, it had just burned bright pink. He had gone to St. Bonaventure University, majoring in communications and hoping to work as a radio journalist, which he had in fact done for minimum wages at a few mom-and-pop stations in upstate New York. When the bagel shop offered to make him head baker, the hourly wage was enough to chuck his infant broadcasting career. So he made bagels and dreamed of adventure. Those be-all-you-can-be commercials that came on during football games spoke straight to his soul. Stebbins had gone to college on an ROTC scholarship, but the Army was so flooded with second lieutenants when he got out that he couldn't get assigned to active duty. When Desert Storm blew up in 1990, as his luck would have it, his National Guard contract was up. He started looking for a way out of the kitchen and into the fire. He put his name on 3 volunteer lists for Gulf service and never even got a response. Then he got married, and his wife had a baby, and suddenly the hourly wage at the bagel shop no longer covered expenses. What he needed was a medical plan. That and some action. The Army offered both, so he enlisted as a private. "What do you want to do in the Army?" the recruiter asked him. Stebbins told him, "I want to jump out of airplanes, shoot a lot of ammo, and shop at the PX." They put him through basic training again. He'd done it once in the ROTC program. Then he had to do RIP, the Ranger Indoctrination Program, twice, because he got injured on one of the jumps toward the end and had to be completely recycled. When he graduated, he figured he'd be out there jumping and training and roping out of helicopters with the younger guys. Except somebody higher up noticed that his personnel form listed a college degree, and more importantly, typing ability. He was routed instead to a desk in the Bravo Company training room. Stebbins became the company clerk. They told him it would just be for 6 months. He got stuck in it for 2 years. He became known as a good training room ranger and fell prey to all the temptations of office work. While the other rangers were out scaling cliffs and jumping out of planes and trying to break their records for forced marches through dense cover, old man Stebby sat behind a desk chain-smoking cigarettes, eating donuts, and practically inhaling coffee. He was the company's most avid coffee drinker. The other guys would make jokes. "Oh, yeah, Specialist Stebbins. He'll throw hot coffee at the enemy." Ha ha. When the company got tapped for Somalia, no one was surprised when old Stebby was one of those left behind at Fort Benning. "I want you to know it's nothing personal," his sergeant told him, although there was no way to disguise the implied insult. "We just can't take you. We have a limited number of spots on the bird, and we need you here." How more clearly could he have stated that, when it came to war, Stebbins was the least valuable ranger in the regiment? It was just like Desert Storm all over again. Somebody up there did not want John Stebbins to go to war. He helped his friends pack, and when it was announced the next day that the force had arrived in Mogadishu, he felt even more left out than he had 2 years before as he watched nightly updates of the Gulf action on CNN. At least he had company. Sergeant Scott Galantine had been left behind, too. They moped around for a few days. Then came a fax from Somalia. "Stebby, you better grab your stuff," his commanding officer told him. "You're going to war." Galantine got the same news. Some rangers had received minor injuries in a mortar attack, and they needed to be replaced. On his way to the airport, Stebbins stopped by his house to say a quick goodbye to his wife. It was the tearful scene you'd expect. Then, when he got to the airport, they told him he could go home. They wouldn't be leaving until the next day. A half hour after their emotional parting, Mr. and Mrs. Stebbins were reunited. He spent the night dreading a phone call that would change the order. But it didn't come. A little more than a day later, he and Galantine were standing on the runway in Mogadishu. In honor of their arrival, they were ordered to drop for 50 push-ups, a ritual greeting upon entering a combat zone. Stebby was thrilled. He'd made it. There weren't enough Kevlar vests, Ranger body armor, to go around, so he got one of the big bulky black vests the D-boys wore. When he put it on, he felt like a turtle. He was warned not to go outside the fence without his weapon. His buddies briefed him on the setup. They told him not to sweat the mortars. Sammy rarely hit anything. They had been on 5 missions at that point, and they were all a piece of cake. "We go in force," they told him. "We move quickly. The choppers basically blow everybody away from the scene. We let the D-boys go in and do their thing. All we do is provide security." They told him to watch out for Somalis who hid behind women and children. Rocks were a hazard. Stebbins was nervous and excited. Then he got the news. See? They were glad to have him there and all, but he wouldn't actually be going out with the rest of the guys on missions. His job would be to stay back at the hangar and stand guard. Maintain perimeter security. It was essential. Somebody had to do it. Who else? Stebbins took out his ire on the folks trying to get past the front gate. He took the guard job as seriously as it was possible to be taken. He was a major pain in the ass. Every Somali got searched from head to toe, every time, in and out. He searched trucks and trunks and carts and climbed up under vehicles and had them open their hoods. It annoyed him that he couldn't figure out a way to search the big tanks on the back of the water trucks. Intel had said the Skinnies were smuggling heavy weapons across the border from Ethiopia. They were told that the Ethiopians checked out all trucks. Stebbins doubted they were checking the water trucks. You could put a lot of RPGs, rocket-propelled grenades, in the back of one of those things. He finagled his way onto the helicopters for the profile flights, fastening the chin strap on his helmet tight as they zoomed low and fast over the city, cheering like kids on a carnival ride. He figured that was about as close to action as he was going to get, and compared to manning the coffee maker in the training room back at Benning, it wasn't bad. Then, this morning, just as the runner from the JOC showed up to shout, "Get it on!" one of the squad leaders strode up with news. "Stebbins, Specialist Sizemore has an infected elbow. He just came back from the doc's office. You're taking his place." He would be the assistant for 60-gunner Private First Class Brian Hurd. Stebbins ran through the hangar, trading in his bulky tortoiseshell vest for a Kevlar one. He'd stuffed extra ammo in his pouches and gathered up some frag grenades. Watching the more experienced guys, he discarded his canteen. They would only be out an hour or so, and stuffed its pouch with still more M16 magazines. He picked up a belt with 300 rounds of M60 ammo and debated trying to stuff more in his butt pack, where he kept the goggles and the gloves he needed for sliding down the rope. He decided against that. He'd need some place to put them when he took them off. He was trying to think through everything, trying to stay calm. But damn, it was exciting.
"Talk to me, Steb. What you got? What's on your mind?" prodded Staff Sergeant Ken Bourne, whose cot was alongside his. Bourne could see his friend was in a state. He told him to relax, keep it simple. His job was to secure whatever sector they asked him to point his rifle at, and give ammo to the 60-gunners when they needed it. They probably wouldn't even need it.
"Okay, fine," said Stebbins.
Just before heading out to the Black Hawk, Stebbins was by the front door of the hangar, sucking on a last cigarette, trying to get his nerves under control. This was finally it, what he'd been aiming for all this time. The guys all knew this was a particularly bad part of town, too. This was likely to be their nastiest mission yet, and it was his first. He had the same feeling in his gut that was there before his first jump at airborne school. "I'm gonna live through this," he told himself. "I'm not gonna die." One of the D-boys told him, "Look, for the first 10 minutes or so, you're gonna be scared shitless. After that, you're gonna get really mad that they have the balls to shoot at you." Stebbins had heard the stories about the other missions, how the Somalis were hit-and-run fighters. There was no way they'd get in a real shit fight. Up on the profile flights, they'd never seen any big weapons.
This was going to be an urban small arms deal. I'm surrounded by guys who know what they're doing. I'm going to be okay.
Now, hitting the street outside the Target building and hearing the pop of distant gunfire, he knew he was in it for real. After untangling himself from the 60 gunner, he ran to the wall. He was assigned a corner pointing south, guarding an alley that appeared empty. It was just a narrow dirt path, barely wide enough for a car, that sloped down on both sides from mud-stained stone walls to a footpath at the center. There were the usual piles of random debris and rusted metal parts strewn along the way, in between the outcroppings of cactus. He heard occasional snapping sounds in the air around him and assumed it was the sound of gunfire a few blocks away, even though the noise was close. Maybe the air was playing tricks on him. He also heard a peculiar noise, a choo, choo, choo. And it dawned on him that this was the sound of rounds whistling down the street. That snapping noise? That was bullets passing close enough for him to hear the little sonic boomlet as they zipped past. Up the street from Stebbins, Captain Steele spotted a likely source for most of the rounds coming through their position. There was a sniper one block west on top of the Olympic Hotel. It was the tallest structure around. Steele bellowed, "Smith!" Corporal Jamie Smith came running. He was the best marksman in the chalk. Steele pointed out the shooter and slapped Smith's back encouragingly. Both men took aim. Their target was a long shot away, more than 150 yards. They couldn't see if they hit him, but after they fired, the Somali on the rooftop was not seen again. Across the alley, hiding behind the inverted frame of a burned-out vehicle, squatted Sergeants Mike Goodale and Aaron Williamson. They were resting their weapons on the hulk, which sloped down from them toward the center of the alley. All the alleys rose from the center in uneven sandy berms to stone courtyard walls and small stone houses on both sides. There were small trees behind some of the walls, and just to the north was the boxy shape of the three-story backside of the Target house. The thick rope they had come down on now lay stretched across the alley. The earth had that slightly orange color, which stained the walls and imparted a rusty tint to the air close to the ground. Goodale could smell and taste the dust mixed with the odor of gunpowder. He heard the shooting at the other side of the block, but their corner was still relatively quiet. Goodale had never felt farther from home in his life, and had a quiet moment or two crouched at that position to wonder how he'd gotten there. Just before leaving for Somalia, he'd gotten engaged to a girl named Kira he'd met in a feckless freshman year at the University of Iowa. They had both escaped Little Pekin, Illinois, for one of the great party campuses of the Midwest, promptly flunked out, and then determined to straighten up. For Mike, that had meant joining the army. For Kira, it was taking a low-level job with an advertising agency. They saw each other frequently when Mike was at Benning, but since the Rangers had been away on a training exercise in Texas before getting the summons for Somalia, they had been apart now for more than 2 months, since the day they'd decided to spend their lives together. The day before, he'd gotten his first chance to phone home since leaving Fort Benning, and he'd gotten the answering machine. He would get another chance to call tonight, and he'd told her on the answering machine to expect it. He knew she'd be waiting by the phone. "Kira, I love you so very much it hurts," he had written her that morning. "I'm reluctant to call again because I know it will just make me miss you that much more. On the other hand, I really want to hear your voice." A Somali, about 100 yards down the road to their left, stuck his head out from behind a wall and rattled a burst with an AK-47. Dirt popped up around Goodale and Williamson. Williamson stepped around to the north side of the hulk. Goodale, who was closest to the shooter, panicked momentarily, thinking the shots were coming from the south. He leapt up and ran from the wreck, hopping as rounds kicked up around him, trying to find some place better to hide. There was no cover. He dove down behind a pipe sticking up from the road.
It was only about 7 inches wide and 6 inches high, and he felt ridiculous cowering behind it, but there was no place else. When the shooting stopped momentarily, he jumped up and rejoined Williamson behind the hulk, just as the Somali started shooting again. Goodale saw the spray of bullets walk up the side of the car, right down the side of Williamson's rifle, and take off the end of his friend's finger. Blood splashed up on Williamson's face, and he screamed and cursed. Goodale leaned over, checking the blood on Williamson's face first, and then his hand. Despite the blood and pain, Williamson seemed more angry than hurt. "If he sticks his head out again, I'm taking him," he said. Severed fingertip and all, Williamson coolly leveled his M16 and waited, motionless, for what seemed like minutes. When the man down the alley leaned out, Williamson fired, and the man's head seemed to explode, and he fell over hard. With his uninjured hand, Williamson and Goodale exchanged a high five and some victory whoops. Moments later, they shot and killed another Somali. The man darted out into their alley and sprinted away from them. As he ran, his loose shirt billowed back to reveal an AK, so they shot him. About 5 Rangers squeezed off rounds at the same time. The man lay on the street only a half block away, and Goodale wondered if they had killed him. He asked the medic if they should check him out, help him if he was just injured, and the medic just shook his head and said, "No, he's dead." It startled Goodale. He had killed a man, or helped anyway. It troubled him. The man had not actually been trying to kill him when he fired, so in the purest sense, it wasn't self-defense. So how could he justify what he had just done? He watched the man in the dirt, his clothes tangled around him, splayed awkwardly where the bullets had felled him. A life like his ended. Was this the right thing? At his corner, about 10 yards east of Goodale and Williamson, Lieutenant Perino watched Somali children walking up the street toward his men, pointing out their positions for a shooter hidden around a corner further down. His men threw flashbang grenades, and the children scattered. "Hey, sir, they're coming back up," called machine gunner Sergeant Chuck Elliott. Perino was on the radio talking to Sergeant Eversman about Blackburn, the ranger who had fallen from the helicopter. The lieutenant was relaying Eversman's information and questions to Captain Steele, who was across the street from him. Perino told Eversman to hold for a second, stepped out, and sprayed a burst from his M16 toward the children, aiming at their feet. They ran away again. Moments later, a woman began creeping up the alley directly toward the machine gun. "Hey, sir, I can see there's a guy behind this woman with a weapon under her arm," shouted Elliot. Perino told him to shoot. The 60 gun made a low blatting sound. The men called the gun a pig. Both the man and woman fell dead. Chapter 7. As he roped in at the northeast corner of the target block, Specialist John Waddell delayed his descent long enough to avoid piling into Specialist Sean Nelson, Chalk 2's 60 gunner, who usually took a second or two longer to untangle himself and his big gun. On a training mission one time, Waddell had plowed into the guy beneath him, and then they'd both been hit by the guy coming after them. That time, he'd bitten his tongue right through. This time, it went well. Waddell got both feet on the ground and then hurried to a wall on the right side of the street, just the way that Lieutenant Tom DiTommaso had drawn it up. Chalk 2 was one long block east of where Sergeant Eversman's Chalk 4 was supposed to have roped down. The lieutenant was concerned because he couldn't see Chalk 4. He managed to reach the embattled sergeant on the radio, and Eversman explained how they'd roped in a block north of their position. DiTommaso sent a team one block north to see if they could spot Chalk 4 from that alley, but they hustled back to report a large crowd of Somalis was massing in that direction. As he ran to take a position against the north wall, Waddell was surprised to find that all his gear weapons and ammo weren't slowing him down. There was a lot of it, and it was bulky and heavy. He carried a big weapon, too, the M249, or SAW, squad automatic weapon. It was a prestige item, a highly portable machine gun that could deal death at 700 rounds per minute. Normally, fully kitted up like that, it felt like gravity had doubled. But Waddell was surprised to find, as he scrambled for a wall, that his arms and legs felt a little numb, but that was it. He figured this was adrenaline, from the excitement and fear, and regarded it with his usual calm detachment. Waddell was a bit of a loner, a precise young man whose dark hair looked especially stark in the standard Ranger buzz cut. After a month of equatorial sun, only his face, neck, and arms were tan. The stupid regs required T-shirts at all times. He was a newcomer to the rifle company, another of Bravo's babies, just 18 years old. Despite a perfect grade point average in high school back in Natchez, Mississippi, he had decided, to his parents' horror, to temporarily forego college and enlist in the Army, to jump out of airplanes and climb cliffs and engage in the other high-risk behavior of an elite infantry unit. Rangering had met his expectations so far, but it whetted his appetite for real action. On this deployment to Moog, he had spent most of his time waiting around and reading. He went through Pulp Fiction by the boxload. Just today, he'd read through to the last chapter of a John Grisham novel that really had him hooked. He found a quiet spot on the top of a Konex container and had planned to finish it. But then they were called to suit up for a possible mission. They'd sat out in the bird, ready to ride out, only to have the mission scrubbed. So he'd stripped down and taken the book back up on the Konex, only to be called back down again to go on a profile flight. He'd suited up again, taken the ride, stripped back down, and was back into the last chapter when they were called for this mission. It felt like the world was conspiring against his finishing that novel. When everybody was down, the rope jettisoned and the Black Hawk gone, Waddell's team was ordered by the lieutenant to set up to help cover Nelson, who had placed his pig on a bipod at the crest of a slight rise in the road and was already shooting steadily. The Chalk's two machine gunners tended to draw most of the fire. Nelson had been working his gun hard before he'd even left the helicopter. Looking down from the open doorway, he'd seen a man with an AK step out to the middle of the street and shoot up through the dust cloud at the bird. Nelson got off 6 rounds at the guy and didn't notice if he'd hit him until he saw him splayed out where he'd been standing. He figured either he'd hit him or the crew chief alongside him had scored with the minigun. Rounds had been snapping around his head when Nelson came down the rope. Not many, but one bullet coming at you is too many. It made him mad. It was always hard to slow his drop down the rope with that big 60 gun strapped on, and Nelson fell over at the bottom. Staff Sergeant Ed Urich had run out to help him to his feet and guide him to a wall. "Man, this is getting hairy fast," Nelson said. Nelson had set up near the center of the road facing west. Up to his right was an alley where he could see Somalis aiming guns his way. Nelson's gun scattered them, all but one, an old man with a bushy white afro further down, who seemed so intent on shooting west that he was unaware of the big gun down the alley to his left. He was still a little too far away to shoot, but Nelson could see the man maneuvering in his direction. The 60 gunner knew what the old man was trying to do. Di Tommaso had spread the word that Chalk 4 was stuck one block northwest of their position. The old man was obviously looking for a better vantage point to shoot at Eversman and his men. "Shoot him! Shoot him!" urged his assistant. "No, watch," Nelson said. "He'll come right to us." And sure enough, the man with the white afro practically walked right up to them. He ducked behind a big tree about 50 yards off, hiding from Eversman's rangers, but oblivious to the threat off his left shoulder. He was loading a new magazine in his weapon when Nelson blasted about a dozen rounds into him. They were slap rounds, plastic-coated titanium bullets that could penetrate armor, and he saw the rounds go right through the man. But the guy still got up, retrieved his weapon, and even got off a shot or two in Nelson's direction. The machine gunner was shocked. He shot another 12 rounds at the man, who nevertheless managed to crawl behind the tree. This time, he didn't shoot back. "I think you got him," said the assistant gunner. But Nelson could still see the afro moving behind the tree. The man was kneeling and evidently still alive. Nelson squeezed off another long